If you'd like to open your Bibles to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, I'll look at it at the end, but if you've got it handy, that's good. Now, when I was a child, my parents were quite annoying. They did things that were universally annoying things that parents did. So when I was hungry, I would say, "I'm hungry," and my father would say, "Hello, hungry, I'm Dad." And lots of things like that. And now I am a parent, I find that when my children go, "I'm hungry," they sound like that. I sounded like, "I'm hungry." No, they sound like, "I'm hungry." And all that I know, it annoys them. So I will say, "Hello, hungry, I'm Dad." And they'll say, "I'm hungry. Hello, hungry, I'm Dad." One of the things that parents do too that they'll offer, as my father would leave the house and I was spend the day with my mother, he would leave a couple of little instructions just as he left, stuff that I was clearly not going to listen to, but he wanted to make sure that I knew before he left. So he'd leave and be like, "Listen to your mother," and then he'd go and leave the house. Now, I do the exact same thing now when I leave. I know my kids are probably, they haven't listened to me all morning, so when I leave the house and say, "Listen to your mother," I'm not really expecting them to listen to their mother, but they certainly should listen to their mother. I know you're wondering where I'm going with this. Today, the Apostle Paul has these kind of leaving the house instructions for the Thessalonian church. They're these little instructions that are just things that he wants them to remember throughout their day. He knows they probably already know whether they're doing it or not. I think the Thessalonians were probably better behaved than I was as a child, so I think they'd probably more likely to listen. But we have this bunch of instructions that are listen to your mother type commands. So things that he wants them to have at the forefront of their mind as they continue to grow. Stuff that they probably should already know, but stuff that they just need to be kept reminded of. So we are at the end of the book of 1 Thessalonians. Next week is Palm Sunday, so we will be looking at that, followed by Good Friday, which is followed by Van Vuren's Moving Saturday, and then followed by Resurrection Sunday. But for today, we're going to say goodbye to this persistent little faithful church, and after Easter, we will get back in touch with them as we start to go through 2 Thessalonians together. So we've spent the last 4 weeks in Thessalonica. We have learned that they were a church in hostile territory. They were in Macedonia, which has a tense history with the Romans, particularly surrounding their habit of the Macedonians trying to raise up kings like their ancestor Alexander the Great to try and win back their country. So when Paul came to them to tell them about King Jesus, who was going to come and save them from oppression and death, many were excited and faithfully turned to Jesus for salvation. But such talk was treasonous, and it got Paul and his friends chased out of the city. However, the little church that was left over thrived. They faithfully followed the teachings of the disciples. They imitated their love, and they are making a name for themselves in the area. Paul sent Timothy to check on them, and he has just returned to Paul with news that they are doing well. So well that most of the other people in the area are starting to take notice, and so well that Paul hasn't got a real lot to say to them except to remind them to continue to do what they're doing, to stick to the truth, to be holy in a city that is anything but, and to place their hope in Jesus, knowing that whatever may happen to them, it is nothing compared to the victory that Jesus has when he returns. Today, we see Paul's finishing reminders. They're a scattergun of things for them to remember so they can continue to follow God faithfully amongst intense pressure. He gives them kind of 3 categories of these reminders. The first is in regards to their attitudes towards others. The second is their attitude towards God. And the third is God's attitude towards them. Now, these are the themes that appear a few times in Paul's other letters. They don't seem to be specific to individual churches, but just common commands that he wants them all to be reminded of. There's not really much indication that these are things that the Thessalonians are specifically struggling with, although one of them will pop up in 2 Thessalonians, so stay tuned for that. But for the moment, we can assume that because, unfortunately, churches are made up with humans, there are certain problems and reminders that are inevitable regardless of the circumstances. So the first reminder is a reminder of the difficulties that we generally have living together with different people. So there are a few things that he wants them to remember and watch out for. The first is to be incredibly appreciative of those who are acting as leaders among them. Now, he doesn't mention leaders or formal role of leadership, but these are the things that leaders do. He says, "Now we ask you, brothers and sisters, to acknowledge those who work hard among you, who care for you in the Lord, and who admonish you. Hold them in the highest regard in love because of their work." So they are those who work hard among them, they care for them in the Lord, and admonish or reprimand them when they do the wrong thing. Now, these are all things that people in leadership positions should do, but they're not necessarily things that just the leaders need to do. They're attributes of a leader. A leader in the congregation is someone who works hard amongst them, cares for them in the Lord, and rebukes people. It's interesting that Paul doesn't say elders or deacons or leaders, but tells them to greatly acknowledge those who are doing the work of leaders and hold them in the highest regard. Now, I am your paid pastor, so the obvious application to this is that you should all hold me in the highest regard. Except that it actually kind of means the opposite. You should not hold me in high regard because of my position, but hold me in regard depending on if I am working hard among you, caring for you in the Lord, and rebuking you. Now, I would think that if someone did those things, you would naturally want to hold them in high regard, and yet I find that I spend a lot of my time hearing about and reading news about celebrities who the world holds in high regard for often no particular reason. The royal interview with Harry and Meghan has rocked the world recently. Some people have defended and felt for the happy royal couple, or unhappy couple, as we found out. But then others have called them entitled liars and whingers. I don't have a horse in that race. But we have a culture that holds celebrity in high regard and wants to know everything about them. They were interviewed by Oprah, who is basically the Queen of America, and she wields incredible influence and power. And whilst Oprah may buy some people a car 10, 20 years ago with her many millions of dollars, she hasn't done much for us lately, and she is not someone whom we are supposed to hold in high regard. We acknowledge those who work among us. It's not people's title or position that we hold in regard, but those who are actually working. If I, as the pastor, am not doing those three things, then find someone who is and get them to admonish or rebuke me. Acknowledge the leaders, the true leaders who are working among us. That might not be people in official positions, but those who are working hard on the sidelines to ensure things are getting done, people are cared for, God's love is going out, those who care, whose care is often incognito. Now, the next thing he says is live in peace with each other. Now, this is definitely the kind of command I would issue to my children as I leave the house, knowing that they're probably 5 minutes away from punching each other. So when Paul says live in peace with one another, it's easier said than done. Peace is a great ideal to uphold until someone has done something that you find reprehensible. Then there's a subtle dissent against that person that you do with your attitude. The thing that you say about that person behind their back, the sigh that you make when someone mentions that person and what they've done. This is often the polite way that we like to wage war with each other. But Paul doesn't leave it with a vague ideal which we have to uphold with our heads but find difficult to follow with our hearts. He gives us a few clues as to how we can avoid these kind of subtle wars that we wage. He says, warn those who are idle and disruptive. Now, I have had experiences in this world where there are those who are not doing the job that I'm doing, don't know anything about the job that I'm doing, but they're very vocal and judgmental about the way that I'm doing that job. I remember volunteering on the sound desk at church when I was a young teenager, and they had an early traditional service for the oldies and a mid-morning family service. I was working the early service one day, which was very easy on the sound desk because they had an organ, and all I really had to do was make sure that the pastor's lapel mic was all right. But one of the things that I would do is I would put the pastor's mic on mute for the songs, because whilst he was a faithful man of God, his faithfulness was not to the correct musical notes in the hymns. One day while I was sitting there, I just leaned forward to push his button on mute for the start of the song, and a grumpy old lady up the back snapped at me and said, "Just leave it, the sound level is fine." Now, this lady had no idea what I was doing. She criticised me for a job that she didn't know how to do, she had no desire to do and no expertise in. She criticised me for something I wasn't doing. And in fact, the pastor had told me at some point that he noticed that I muted him for the songs and he thanked me because he knew where his faithfulness was to God and not to songs. I think this kind of action is the sort of thing that Paul is talking about. Those who are idle and disruptive, those who are not doing the work but telling other people how they should be doing it and causing trouble. Now, this is not to say that people should not have negative opinions on things or offer earnest feedback. Earlier on, Paul praised people who rebuke, but we need to be careful how we offer each other feedback. I welcome feedback for my sermons. If you didn't like something or found something confusing or poorly explained or I looked a little weird, then please come and talk to me about it, because how you experience my sermons is important for me to know. If you walk past me at the door and say, "That sucked, do better next time," and walk home, that's not very helpful and is only really going to probably make my sermons worse as I spend ages tearing my hair out trying to work out what your impossible standard is that I don't know. Now, if you are someone who preaches and offers me advice on how I could improve my sermon, then I would be even more likely to listen to you, because I know you have some idea of what it takes to put a sermon together and preach it. So we need to be careful about how we give feedback to each other. Now, the next couple of commands seem to go along with this countering hurtful actions. He says, encourage the disheartened, help the weak, be patient with everyone. So instead of being idle and disruptive, you take the person discouraged by circumstances who was told that their sermon sucked and had to leave, and you encourage them. When someone discourages me, I think that they're usually criticizing me because they think that that will help me do a better job. But all it really does is make me not want to do anything. I am discouraged. I no longer have the courage to do the job. The solution to that is encouragement. Give the person the tools they need to do the job and help them to do it. If you find my sermons get really bogged down in historical context of a book and you find that difficult to follow and boring, then instead of saying to me, "Your sermon is boring," not that anyone actually does this, you're all too polite for that, but instead of saying something is boring or terrible, you don't like it, you could come and say to me that you really like it when I relate the text to your experience and your world. You like it when there is a really good practical application. Then the next time when I go to write my sermon, I will probably consciously or unconsciously spend a bit more care on my application and cut out that bit about Roman coins and what they found on them and tell us whatever it is that Roman coins tell us. There is a temptation in our society to tear down those who we think are not doing a good job. The internet has given rise to 1 billion armchair critics. And in the face of that, as Christians in a church family, we have the same goal as each other and the desire to get there together, not to tear down, but to build up. So when someone is discouraged, we encourage them. When we are weak, we help them. We are patient with everyone. It takes more effort to build something than it does to tear something down. We are kingdom builders, not world destroyers. And the last little bit of advice in this section is a reminder of the story that is the basis of all that we believe, the forgiveness of God. Because God forgave us, we show that forgiveness to the world by forgiving others and doing good and showing grace in the face of our own hurt and desire for revenge. So Paul says, make sure nobody pays back wrong for wrong, but always strive to do what is good for each other and for everyone else. So in our attitude towards each other, we hold those who do God's work among us in high regard because of their work. We warn those who would needlessly cause disruption. We build each other up instead of tearing each other down. Instead of seeking revenge on those who wrong us, we offer forgiveness and we do good. Now, all of this sounds simple and easy until you put your emotions and your feelings in the mix. So the next thing he tells us, he gives us the tools to accomplish them. The first is about our attitude towards God. He says, rejoice always, pray continually, give thanks in all circumstances. So our actions towards God is to have continual attitude of thanks, rejoicing, and contact to God through prayer. Now, this is another one of those verses that's very easy to understand but difficult to do. Now, I could tell you that by being thankful, rejoicing, and praying, the actions of doing these things inevitably change your attitude, which is true. But the reason that Paul has for us as to why we should do these things is not simply to trick our minds into having a better or happier mood or attitude, whilst a good attitude is a good reason. The reason that Paul gives us for praising and thanking and praying is that this is God's will for us in Christ. Now, God's will is what is best for us. Earlier in the letter, he said that it is God's will for our lives to be sanctified. He wants us to be continually improving and growing and becoming more like the way that he wants humanity to be, for our benefit and the benefit of the world. And now his will for us is to be continually praising and thanking and praying. He doesn't want us to be bitter and tearing down and inwardly churning over our bad